You're listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network, now the largest new media platform on the web, and your number one source for after-show entertainment.
Very good, Gene
Johnson.
Maria Menounos and Bing.com present live from the Kari Feinstein Oscar Style Lounge at the world-famous Mondrian Hotel on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, California. And streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies, this is AfterBuzz TV's Movie Edition. Tonight's AfterBuzz movie is Midnight in Paris. We'll break down everything from the making of Midnight in Paris to behind the scenes and everything in between. And now, another post-game wrap-up show for your favorite movie. It's AfterBuzz TV's Midnight in Paris.
Buddy, thank you for joining us for another AfterBuzz TV podcast. It's Friday, the Friday before the 2012 Academy Awards. We're coming to you live from the Kari Feinstein Oscar-style lounge gift suites. We're at the Mondrian Hotel here on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California. I'm your host, John Comerford. I'm joined on the panel by Mari Fagel. Please say hi.
Hello.
Jessica King.
Hi, guys.
And Jackie Moran.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Very exciting to be here. We had a great day yesterday. We had a lot of guests come by. We had, we had the author of the Help come by. We also had the producer of the movie, Bronson Green, come by. We had one of the stars, Anna O'Reilly. We had Stephen Bishop, who played a great job as David Justice in Moneyball opposite Brad Pitt. Today we've already had Erica Dizel. Had a lot of vendors come by. In fact, I've just been told we have a vendor coming by right now. And please come in and have a seat. Tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Karen Webster.
Get that mic. Pull that mic right in there. There you go.
Okay, right up in here.
Thank you very much. And who are you? And what are you?
My name is Karen Webster, and I'm president and co-founder of Glitterings Inc. And we are here today with an array of jewelry from several different brands that we feature. So we're all about the bling.
Aha! Perfect for the Academy Awards. Nice.
Amazing.
Beautiful.
So we do lots of rings. We're known for our beautiful fashion cocktail rings, which are really red carpet ready. And we call them faux real, the double take fake, because they look so good. No one would ever know that they're fake. And they are done in such good quality, and everyone just loves them. And then we're also launching a line with Jill Zarin.
Oh, wow.
We're doing her jewelry.
Real Housewives
of New York. This is one of her rings from our micro collection that we just launched for her this month. And then we have a full collection coming to department stores later on this year in the fall. So we're really excited about that.
Terrific.
And we also have got Carolina Motto Jewelry, and she does some beautiful pieces. She's inspired by the sea and lots of classical elements. So she's got an amazing collection, lots of details, Swarovski stones. Everyone's loving it. We're hoping to see some of those on the red carpet on Sunday.
Well, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate
you
stopping
so by. Much.
Please remind everybody who you are and where they can find you.
Glitterings, glitterings.com.
There you go.
Carolina Amato, carolinamatojewelry.com, and the Jill Zarin Jewelry Collection.com.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So that's the way it is here at the Gift Lounge. We never know who's going to be stopping by. We're happy to have vendors come by, and as stars and producers and editors come in, we'll have them come down, give us their take on the Oscars, their reactions to the movies, and everything. Speaking of movies, we're talking Midnight in Paris. I almost said Midnight Express. Midnight in Paris is a much
different
movie. So what's your initial reactions to Midnight in Paris? Thoughts?
I'll give mine first, because my initial reaction has to do with, to me, the whole movie could be the opening montage for me. That 3-minute opening montage, I was in my bed at midnight in New York watching this, and I read that he got his impressions of Paris from Hollywood cinema, and for me, I've been in so many cities, but I've never been to Paris, and I unexpectedly popped this movie on, didn't even hear much about it, I know there wasn't that much marketing, and I was wowed. Like, I truly felt in 3 minutes, out of nowhere, boom, I was in Paris. The way he put the scenes together, to me, I was swept in 3 minutes, and I think that is one of my favorite movie openings of all time, and of course, we got swept into the fantasy right off the bat, so for me, I was just in love. It was a love letter to Paris. I was in love in 3 minutes.
I love it. Well, Jessica? I was also in bed watching the film.
We
I actually went to a theater.
Should we say what we were wearing?
I did this wrong, I think.
And you know what? I had heard so much about it already, so I went into it with such high expectations. And I had already started doing a little bit of reading on it, and I know that Woody was going for this romantic style, and I immediately felt like it was just so romantic, so beautiful. And throughout the film, I never got bored.
Yeah.
I really was just so intrigued by everything. I love the aha moments when you're, you know, along with Owen, kind of like figuring everything out.
Right.
And that was just awesome because I just felt so into it. I felt like I was there learning along with him all of these new things.
Okay. Mari.
I was also in bed in New York watching the film.
Were we
I think that has to be a prerequisite from now on. See this movie from bed.
But that's also... It swept you away because, yes, you expect to go to the theaters and be swept away. We were sitting in bed in New York, probably on a snow-cold day, and I was swept away not only to another place, but another time.
Yes.
And I loved it. I mean, what is more romantic than Paris in the 20s? I mean, and you really felt it. You felt like you were there along with Owen Wilson.
Right.
And I loved just... He set everything perfect. The music, the costumes, this like the landscape, this everything. You felt like you were there. And we'll talk about
you want to be there.
The aha moments were a little like much for me because I think maybe I aha'd a little later than my boyfriend because
right.
he works in art and he was like, oh, this person, Gertrude Stein,
right.
like Cole Porter. And I was like, wait, who, hold on.
No, it's so funny you say that because for me, the biggest thing was that I am not a history buff. I am like the most clueless movie watcher. Anytime I watch a movie, I don't know what's going on until after it's over and somebody tells me. But there was a critic that said, you can watch this and the references can go over your head and you can still love it.
Yeah.
And I watched it both ways. I watched it before I researched it, and then I researched it and I watched it again, and it was a totally different movie, but I loved it both times. And that's what's so great about it.
Well, I have to say, I didn't watch it from bed. I actually went to the theater, and I wasn't in a reclined position. I wasn't swept away. No, I'm kidding.
Now I was going to get nervous.
No, I was just
How
kidding.
Could you not?
No, I wasn't. I interrupted you. What were you going to say, Jessica?
No, I was just off of what Jackie said. I think that's such a great thing about the movie because a lot of the artists that he references are artists that we've read about in grade school and high school and growing up, you know. So even if you don't know a whole amount of knowledge about them, you can still somehow feel in it and relate to them.
Okay. I just have to quickly say, I'm sorry, what I'm impressed by the film is, so I don't really know that many of the historical references. I got them, yes. But for people who work at Sotheby's, my boyfriend works at Sotheby's, that's like, you know everyone. You know art very, very well. And you think that would be a hard crowd to impress.
Right.
You'd think the movie would come across as cliche. They loved it. They were telling him, you have to see this film. This film is remarkable. So to impress the people who actually study the artists who are in this film on a daily basis, you got one right, Woody Allen.
Well, there you go. So, and for anybody who doesn't know, it is the story of Gil Bender, a hack Hollywood screenwriter who wants to be a novelist. He has an affinity, a love for the 1920s in Paris especially. He goes to Paris with his fiancée and her family. And one night he's out walking at midnight. A mysterious Rolls Royce just pulls up. The occupants kind of beckon him in and then transport him to a whole right back to the 1920s. Meets Hemingway, Zelda, and Scott Fitzgerald. Cole Porter singing at the piano. And all these people he's dreamed about his whole life. He gets to meet them. And the story unfolds from there. So... Now, that's the movie. Now, before it became a movie, let's hear the story of how it became one.
Well, it was so interesting to read about how this film was incepted and where it came from, because I feel like Woody Allen has such a different way of bringing his movies about. So I was actually very surprised he kind of took a backwards method to it. He says that he knew he wanted to do a film in Paris because he loves Paris, so that was a dead on right there. And then,
if I can interject real quick, he loved Paris since the first time he went, which is when they were filming What's New, Pussycat, and he was the writer on it.
Right. Yes.
He loved it. The movie. He didn't like the movie so much, whatever, but he loved the city, wanted to stay there. In fact, did you read about his friends decided to live there?
Told them to move with
and
him.
He didn't have the courage to live there.
Yeah. Right.
And went back.
So Woody
ever
Allen
since
is
there.
Gil?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Through
he
so
always
much.
Wanted to go back. So please continue that.
He knew he wanted to film in Paris.
Right.
And he was kind of, when he thinks of Paris, he thinks of romance. And so he knew he wanted some type of romantic feel to the movie. So then he came up with the title, Midnight in Paris. And from there, he had no idea what was going to happen at midnight.
Yeah.
So he says he put it down for a little bit and didn't think about it. And then finally, he kind of thought, you know, it would be cool if this car just comes around at midnight and picks up the protagonist. And the next thing you know, he's transported into another time. Yes. And he just kind of flew with it.
Yeah. Which is great, because usually you write the story, and then it's only afterwards that you figure out what the story is or what the title is.
And it's an unknown project for a while, untitled.
Does that happen a lot?
Unwritten.
that you write the title and then the movie
No, no. It's usually the other way around.
Yeah. I was saying it's backwards.
Usually.
Yeah.
It's a totally unique attempt at
it. Usually you're writing to an idea or a theme or something like that. You rarely write to a title.
Yeah. And a great thing, too, we were just talking about how even though we don't know a whole lot about the artists that were involved in the film, we were still able to relate to them. He said that he didn't do any research for this project.
Isn't that amazing?
I can't believe it.
Well, I think that's why it worked. Because he wasn't writing to an historical Hemingway. He was just writing to his... First of all, it's in Gil's mind.
Right.
Who knows if it was real or not?
Right.
So he's writing to the idea that Gil has of Hemingway.
Yep.
Who he wants him to be, who he thinks he is, or whatever it is. Yep. So he could write whatever he wanted. They humanized Hemingway rather than historicalize him.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it was worth.
And he just took it from there. He said he's learned about all of these writers and read about them in school.
It's in his brain.
And it's just in his brain, and he just wrote off the top of his head.
And I like that he never really cared about writing to the science of time travel. It was a magical, mystical thing.
Right.
Never hinted at it, didn't care. Resolved at the end by some guy supposedly trying to find him and ending up in the, in the Renaissance era or something like that.
And I think that's why the movie worked.
I agree. That he didn't spend any time doing that.
But you said that he humanized them. So even historians watching film, someone who studies F. Scott Fitzgerald, it wouldn't bother him because maybe everything wasn't fully accurate or didn't tell the whole story. But it humanized him and his love story, his love-hate relationship with Zelda, and that's something that anyone could relate to.
Yeah. And it's not like this.
The relationships were very relatable, even though it was really on the surface all about the imagery and the fantasy. But you could relate to all these characters too, and now. And the going back in time part is the nostalgia and just getting swept up in that.
Yeah.
And even if you are a little buzzed at midnight and you're watching it, it's still great because you can just half watch it and love it.
Right.
But also, it's very relatable too, and humanizes is a really great point. And I'm glad that he did Paris and romance, because I also saw that he said, if it were Berlin, I'd do a spy movie or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is why it's one of his most successful films, is because
it is the
hard not to fall. Yeah, it is the most successful.
It's the highest
grossing
Woody Allen film.
Who doesn't love Paris? It's just
especially when you have an imagery and memory of Paris based on the cinema, because it's always lit beautifully, people fall in love there, all that kind of stuff. So we've already got all that going into it.
But I think what's so important is the dichotomy between his idealized version of Paris and the actual version of the Paris trip he's in. And because you want to think, Paris is so romantic in this love story, he meets Marion Cotillard, but in real life, this love story is a love story gone wrong with Rachel McAdams. And you want to, I think he also pokes fun at those people who are so historically accurate and I'm an expert in something, in the character of Michael Sheen.
Yes.
He's so annoying, you're like, oh my god, you hate that person.
And Rachel McAdams too is annoying.
That is an important theme in it, is the dichotomy between the romanticized version and the annoying.
You just mentioned Rachel McAdams. Let's get into how he cast that. So why did he choose the one?
My thing is the acting in this. I really think, of course, this is all Woody Allen, and he's an icon in every single right, and he's rightfully so nominated. But what about the acting? Because for me, I feel like if you think back to, believe it or not, Woody Allen watched Wedding Crashers, and we have Rachel McAdams and Owen Wilson back again. And if you look at them on Wedding Crashers, or Zoolander, or Sherlock Holmes for Rachel McAdams, and then you look at them in this, I think that they take their characters so well. And it was funny with Rachel McAdams. He knew of all the actors that he wanted her, and he approached her with it. And the funny thing about the actors is they all had the same thing in common. They were all starstruck by working with Woody Allen.
They say you don't do it for the money, you do it to work with Woody.
For a portrait with Picasso, is what Owen Wilson said. And Rachel McAdams said she was jumping on the chance, and he was almost talking her out of it, because he was like, she's not the object of desire. you know, if you don't want to do it, fine. You may not want to do it. Like, he was asking her and talking her out of it at the same time, and she was like, yes, 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 I want to do it. So that was interesting. And then with Owen Wilson, I thought what was interesting is he originally, as Woody Allen does, wrote him as Gil as an East Coast character.
Really shocking that Woody Allen would write a lead as an East Coast guy.
And, you know, I think that that change, he rewrote the character to fit Owen Wilson because it was the casting director that suggested Owen Wilson. And it's not often that someone rewrites a character, but I think it was the best decision that made this movie what it was.
I'm allowed to say this because I'm from LA and I live in New York, so I'm allowed to talk down on New York a little bit. I don't think
Wait a minute, I'm from New York.
I don't think it would have worked if he was a screenwriter from New York, because screenwriters from New York, I don't think, would have been swept up in the fantasy.
Yeah, you can believe
it.
Cynical.
Optimistic. A screenwriter from New York would have been cynical.
Much more jaded.
A screenwriter from LA is so optimistic and he can get swept up in it all.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's why I say I think it was the biggest game changer for this movie. And I think Owen Wilson was amazing. Can we, like, talk about that? I think they're not nominated, but I think a couple of people here, really, Owen Wilson, you really believed him. You believed that he was so enamored with everything. And even on set, when they were rehearsing, he was enamored with the process. He never met Woody until he got to France.
Right.
And he was so starstruck by him. He's, like, was trying to figure out ways to connect with him. They only talked about the weather and the fact that he was checking the iPhone with the weather with Woody Allen. Yeah. He was like, I'm shocked he had an iPhone. But I think it's funny. It's almost like that uncomfortable father-in-law or something that you're, like, afraid to talk to. But the direction, he's known for not being very hands-on, and they were all kind of nervous to work with him. And I think that they said they were, it's all, though, an experience they will all cherish, and they all got along great, and the hours and the way he produces and directs made for, like, the best working environment you could ask for. And I think it shows. Their chemistry with each other really shows. And I think it's amazing to look at where they came from, Wedding Crashers, to now.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Okay, I have to ask the girls this question, because Rachel McAdams, to us, is she's the romantic heroine in all the films, in The Notebook, The Vow. And so seeing her in this as, like, that bitchy, cold, stick-up-her-ass,
as long as Mari's saying it, not me.
Sorry. You knew that she could do it because
I'm getting the vapors.
She's how women
she
talk.
She's a mean girl in Mean Girls. So you knew she had it in her. But it's always hard watching Rachel McAdams, like, in a love story, but she's not the one giving and getting the love.
But isn't that what Woody said to Rachel when he met with her? Like, you know, you always play the nice girl, and every once in a while you gotta be the bitch.
Well,
and
I think she said it was less pressure. Because
she didn't have to carry it.
That kind of role, you don't have to worry about pulling it off and being likable. I mean, so she said it was actually, like, a welcome thing, but I agree that when I watched it, I hated her, and I was like, wait, I don't know if I want to hate her, but I do, so she did a great job.
That's what I'm saying. She obviously did a good job, because I hated her, and I love Rachel McAdams.
Right.
She's one of my favorite actresses, and I was not feeling it. I was just like, why is she acting like this? This is so not Rachel McAdams.
I know. And by the way, a little bit of gossip. I mean, they're stepping out now, but she met her boyfriend, Michael Sheen, they met on the set, and they've been dating ever since that movie.
She does that a lot.
Does she? Uh-oh.
She dated,
well, they're still dating, though.
She dated
Mari knows the
Ryan Gosling after The Notebook, but she always says this, I don't know if I believe her, she always says that she only starts dating them after filming ends. Oh, how appropriate.
That makes a difference.
Wow.
Yeah, hopefully this one will last. We'll see.
And the last thing that I thought was interesting is that some of them don't get to see the whole script when they're acting. Like, Michael Sheen didn't even know that he had an affair with Rachel McAdams. How funny is that?
Yeah, he had to learn that after the film.
Right.
Not only in real life, but in the movie.
Right.
So.
But that makes for a hard working condition, I
think.
Well,
yeah, Woody's known for only giving the actors just their portion, so without giving them the story.
That's so crazy, because you could tell, like, when I finally found out they had an affair, and I was like, oh, I knew it. And then my boyfriend who's watching with me was like, I called it from the beginning. I knew they had an affair. So that's crazy to think that you didn't, the characters themselves didn't find out till the end that they had an affair, because they set it up so well the entire time. Like, you knew they weren't just dancing.
That's,
I think that's such an interesting approach, though, because if he had read the end of it, he may have played that character differently.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know? So,
and you could have, the film would have worked even if you didn't think he was happy. Even if they didn't have an affair, it wasn't really the affair so much, that was, they weren't in love anyway. They shouldn't have been together.
Yeah. And I didn't even, like I said, a few things went over my head. Yeah. So the affair didn't even come to mind until Stein had mentioned it. That's what I was saying, the aha moments. I was like,
right, I know.
So, I mean, it was just great.
So many things went over my head. Thank gosh I watched it a few times. And, you know, the smallest part that I don't want to forget to mention is Carla Bruni, because the museum guide, a couple of lines, but she's the wife of the president of the French Republic, and she, that was so smart of Woody Allen, I think, because to give her a few lines, she made the tabloids went crazy over it. It's like free marketing right there.
Exactly.
And we know they had a small budget, so they were printing, like, nonstop, the paparazzi, the tabloids, printing that she couldn't, she's never acted before, that she couldn't get her lines out, and they had to do a lot of takes, and they didn't use all the scenes, and he said, absolutely not, she was fabulous. Owen Wilson said she was so down to earth, and she did great, and every scene was in the film. But that little part caused so much controversy as they were filming, which I think is so funny. But it was a smart move by him.
Yeah.
I think.
Who knows if he even planned the controversy. I don't know. But it was great marketing. So, yeah, she did a great job.
And Marion Cotillard. He said he can't get tired of looking at her.
Who can? She's gorgeous.
And she was perfectly cast because, like Rachel McAdams, you don't normally expect that. Marion Cotillard, she was perfectly cast in the role of that, like, 1920s. She's almost, and it's funny because she's a 1920s groupie. When you think of groupie now, it kind of has a negative like.
For whom?
Like, you think of, I don't know, Backstreet Boys groupie, or I don't know. Like, a groupie is not a good thing, but back in the 1920s, like, a groupie of Picasso.
Yeah.
It was so romanticized.
Well, they had groupie and muse kind of mixed together, so.
No, but she, of course, making a film in Paris, in France, of course, she's a French actress, but she's also an Academy Award winner. And she's another one that I wonder if she got overlooked, because I feel like she really brought some kind of authenticity to the feeling of France and getting swept away. And I don't know if someone else could have done that. Maybe she just didn't have enough.
Maybe Audrey Tautou. Maybe
just the way she talks, you know. I'm just like, I want to sway with her.
And we're
like,
women.
So the accent's working even if it's a woman saying it?
Yes.
Wow.
I
didn't know that.
I have to ask you, when it went from his fantasy to her fantasy from 1920s
to the Belle Epoque
to Renaissance, what did you guys think about that? Because even my dad, who's like a history buff, he got lost in it. He was like, oh wait, we jumped to another time period?
Can I actually tell you the truth?
Ahead.
The first time I saw it,
you didn't
went
know?
Right over my head.
Yeah, okay.
Because as I said, I was half falling asleep. By then it was 2 in the morning. And, but I didn't care because, you know, and then you watch it again and you really get all. And
well, he had the great visual references with the clothing and the location, and then of course the Lusitrec. So if you weren't half asleep, those are the cues to bring you into the Belle Epoque.
From a writing perspective, what did you think of his shift from?
I had no problem with it at all.
Okay.
Once I bought into the fantastical, and again, in my mind, I just accepted that this is Gil's world.
Right.
I didn't for a second thought it was real. For all I know, he fell asleep in midnight and just on the street and had this in his dream.
Yeah. Right.
So I didn't care.
I was initially a little confused by it. As we talked about earlier, I'm not the hugest history person. So it kind of jumped. Like, I didn't at first realize that it was a different car that was picking them up. And so I was it took me a while to catch on. But then I caught on pretty quickly, you know, once they were kind of ending the dream. And I loved that. I loved the whole, you know, pretty much the grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
And that's something that we all deal with today. And so I loved that because I feel like, at least for me, I'm always dreaming of what it would be like. And then the next person is always dreaming opposite of what it would be like. And so I think it was a great kind of like life lesson almost.
Exactly.
We always think about it being better somewhere else, some other time.
Yeah. Well, at first I was like, wait, why are we jumping to a different fantasy? I think it was really important in wrapping up the story of everyone has a dream time. Everyone has a period of history they want to go back to. So he thinks 1920s is the best time, but the people in 1920s think the 1890s, 1870s is the best time.
Well, we all look backwards, and there's this golden hue over our memories because we forget all the challenges. Every era has its own challenge.
Right.
So therefore, by contrast, the one out there looks easier.
Yeah.
It's better, looks prettier, whatever.
I wanted to ask ask you about...
I mean, women forget childbirth, for crying out loud.
I mean, and I wanted to ask you about the casting of Adrian Brody, because Adrian Brody, he's huge. I mean, he's an Oscar-winning actor, and I kind of felt like his role was not that strong, and I think people, critics agreed with me, because he kind of was just like, I'm Dali. Like, that's literally all he said.
Right.
And that was...
Well, it's funny for a big-name actor... He, as far as, like, reviews and things like that, like, he barely got any attention, like, as far as when I was looking over things and researching and what popped up. He was always in the cast, as far as the group, but I feel like he was kind of, like, in and out, and I don't think he impacted it, to be honest. But
in terms of marketing the film, his name was thrown out.
Right, his name was important in marketing, but as far as importance to the movie, I don't know if he... He paled in comparison, even with people with small parts.
And, but it also didn't help that he was playing a, you know, Dadaist.
Right.
I mean, so he's not really, he's surrealist, so he's not going to make any sense anyway.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
It's going to be hard to make sense in a movie.
You know, I don't think he should have gotten a nomination, that's for sure. But I do think some of these other cast members really, like Owen Wilson, Woody said that he doesn't feel like someone acting. He feels like a guy just talking.
Very natural.
And I love that. And when you see it in this, yes, he's in silly movies sometimes. But when you saw him in this, I think it made me realize how good Owen Wilson is.
I think the problem is... He doesn't get nominated because he doesn't ever seem like he's acting.
It looks effortless.
He's always you know what I mean?
Like, so natural about
it. He doesn't ever seem like he's acting.
And I also
he also doesn't take roles in a real meeting.
He lives in Hawaii and he smokes pot with Woody Harrelson, and you could tell that's what he's like in all the movies.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I also feel like a lot of Woody Allen movies just get looked at as a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's not necessarily about the actors and actresses.
A lot of people didn't like his portrayal because it sounded too much like... They thought he was ripping off Rudy and trying to imitate him. Which I went, what? I didn't see that at all. But you have a guy in a Woody Allen movie who is a little neurotic, maybe is insecure about something, and he's going to be compared to Woody Allen, no matter what he does.
Right. But I don't think... I agree. Like, I don't think he was... I didn't feel like he was imitating him at
what
all.
Do you mean?
And I think that's what made the character so good, is because he made it Owen Wilson. He made it feel natural. And that's something everybody was saying from Woody to Owen, that never did they feel like they were alike, and they weren't trying to be. And he didn't want him. That's why he rewrote the character. He didn't want him to try to be that East Coast guy. And I think that he executed
I think he did a great job.
Yeah,
and even
really
beyond
do.
Him, I thought, Corey Stoll playing Hemingway, I thought he did a great job.
Absolutely.
You know who did a great job, and I love her, is Kathy Bates.
Yeah.
Gertrude
Stein. She was just this mothering, artistic font of the...
And it is harder when you have to portray somebody who did exist. You know, you have more, I think, because you have more things to live up to, whereas you can interpret a created character however you want. You have to pinpoint with some accuracy. It was a fantasy, but you do have to pinpoint what you would picture Gertrude Stein to be. And I think she did amazing. I think Roger Ebert, I think, said, like, you don't know what she was like, but that's what you would picture her.
That's what you wanted to be
exactly.
like. That's exactly what I felt.
Like that mothering role. You know what she kind of reminded me of? She does it so well, but you know in Titanic, she plays the
unsinkable monogram.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, not that they're the same, but it was just, she does it so well. She delves into the character, and Gertrude Stein wasn't even that big of a part of the movie, but I remember her almost the most.
And I feel like
her comparison for Adrian Brody, like I was saying, she didn't have a huge part, but she had a huge impact, you know, and I think that's a testament to her.
And I feel like her character kind of helped guide me through the movie as well, because as she was telling Gil all of these new revelations, like I said before, I was learning along with him, and so her character was very crucial to my understanding of the film.
Well, she represents his creative force, his creative input. I mean, without her, he can't finish the novel, can't understand what's happening in his relationship.
That's a great role to have. I feel like, it was a small role, but it was just made her look, I wonder as an actor, when you look at these parts, you're like, I'm going to come off awesome in this. Like, I feel like they must think that, like her at least. It's different with Rachel McAdams. But that's just a great role, I'm sure, to come your way, and that's why you would take it, even though it's a smaller role, because I think it just made her look amazing as an actress. And, I'm surprised that, I think more than anybody, I'm surprised Kathy Bates and Owen Wilson didn't get some kind of recognition in the for the Oscars. But
oh, look who we got, somebody coming in.
Interrupt.
Who do we got?
Candon here. We have a surprise from Sabra Hummus. So I'm going to pass this out to you guys. I could tell, Jackie. I could tell you guys were starving.
We were famished.
Sorry, John. So it's all natural gluten-free hummus from Sabra. And this is the hummus roasted garlic, actually, served with pretzel. So it's really good. And they're one of our vendors here today at the Style Lounge.
Excellent.
Yeah, you guys are doing a great job.
In their little cart. So if you're outside,
the little cart was so cute. And I'm a hummus lover, so I was happy to have it. All right, guys, we're doing a great job. Thanks to Sabra for some little snacks.
Thank
you guys keep doing your thing.
Midnight snack. Midnight in Paris snack.
Couldn't resist that one.
And as we talk about all of the characters in the film, just as important as an actual actor is setting the tone for it. And so I thought the music was actually could have been another character in the film because it set the tone so well. I mean, Cole Porter actually was in the film, but obviously then the Cole Porter music and then all of the music from the 1920s and 1930s, the jazz, the French jazz, and that was such an important scene. You talked about the opening scene.
Right.
It
picture
set
that without
up.
The music.
Yeah.
The shots of Paris and the editing of that, though, everything was so important for getting you in the mood. Like, absolutely. The second you watch those first 3 minutes, you're like, oh, Paris. And the music in that is so important. And so that's why he played Sidney Bechet throughout that opening opening scene. And so Sidney Bechet, Josephine Baker, Cole Porter, the entire soundtrack, if you look at it, is all French jazz. Because also the composer of the film is a man who he worked with in the past in Vicky Cristina Barcelona and Stephen Rembel. And his song was featured in it, the title feature, Bistro Fada. And so I think that the music, also the costumes, everything, those are all other characters in the film because they helped to set up the scene.
Honestly, for me, the music, the way you were saying that Gertrude Stein kind of led you through, the music led me through. I feel like, first off, my favorite scene, as I said, the music combined with what we were seeing is what took me there. I mean, without that, da-da-da-da-da, I mean, it's not there, you know? Right. And so to me, that and the fact that all the transitions took back into time, when you hear Cole Porter, boom, you're there.
Yeah.
Without that, and of course the costume, and, you know, another thing that we should recognize, I mean, not Woody Allen is noted as a style icon. You don't look at him and think it, but he creates style icons throughout his career. And again, you're seeing the 20s come up on the runways of spring 2012 in New York, and Ralph Lauren showing flapper style again. And you have to think that they're connected because he's known for creating style icons. And not only the style of taking you back in time, but Rachel McAdams' style of today. She's somebody who you look at and you'd want to have, that's who you'd want to be going to Paris today. So that, with the music, to me, is what transitioned me and made me follow along and get into those different time periods.
And I just want to read what one of the critics wrote of the music and just setting the tone. He said, from the first note of music over a dark screen, a soprano saxophone played by some ghost of Sidney Bechet, Midnight in Paris teases us into expecting nothing more or less than a charming pastiche of the bits and pieces that pop up in many Woody Allen films. The jazz score from another era introduces scenes of the city, not Manhattan in black and white splendor, but Paris under a bright summer sun.
Yeah. I think music in general sets the tone for whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, it's an emotional cue.
Exactly, and we talk about how we felt like we were in it, and like you said, that music just kind of puts you there, and you feel like you're just, you know, you could be in Paris with Gil and Inez watching everything, you know, take place.
And I think with films, music is one of the most important elements, but sometimes with some films, it's not like the element. This is one of those movies where it was one of the, like, starring role elements.
It was another character.
I'm going to go off on that because we just talked about the opening, and along with the music, I think the imagery, because let's talk a little bit about the cinematography, because one of the things they did to set that tone was everything. Woody wanted everything intensely warm, and especially that opening sequence. All those shots had this warmth, this golden hue to them that, first of all, just brought you into the city of lights, brought you into that, oh yeah, isn't that pretty? And also helped add to the magical, mystical quality going on. So everything had this little glint to it. And I think that helped transport you. When we went back to 1920s, he kind of lifted that up even more. So you felt like you were in that bygone era. So they specifically designed it so to bring you into that idealized romance of Paris, and then when we got to 1920s, they just elevated a little more, just so you could feel like, oh wow.
The lighting for me was another unspoken kind of thing that you don't even realize how much it makes a difference, but it makes a huge difference. And on the acting side, I know a few actresses and models that say the lighting man is your best friend.
Oh, yeah.
You make best friends with lighting. And
yeah.
That's another one of those actresses.
I need to interrupt you, but we have comedian. We have comedian and huge fan, Judy Tenuta. She loves Midnight in Paris, so she will talk to you guys about it. And
great.
Here she is.
Hello,
Judy.
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, everybody's hair is so beautiful.
Even mine?
That was yours. That was yours.
Oh, really? Thank you.
You fit right in.
Thank you.
I love this movie. Midnight in Paris, I saw it twice. You know, I want to be the Owen Wilson character and get picked up in that car and then go to all these parties with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And I love the Ernest Hemingway character.
Oh, it's great.
Who is that guy?
Corey Stoll.
What's his name?
Corey Stoll.
Corey Stoll. I need to find him.
Yeah. I have to ask you, did you get every single one of the references? Did you get, so obviously you got Hemingway.
Yeah, but that's because I was born before you. Yeah, so I would know Ernest Hemingway. Yeah. I know who Ernest Hemingway is, of course.
Yeah.
And F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda Fitzgerald.
Sure.
And,
did you get the one in Marion Cotillard's version of
yeah, Degas, Gauguin, and Toulouse Trick. Yeah, see, she and I,
two different kind of
movies.
I'm a history buff.
You're much younger, so you might not know those things.
We were talking about how a few things went over our head initially, but as we watched it more, and some of us watched it more than once, we were able to get those
references.
Here's
the nice thing. You can Google everything. If you don't know something, you can just Google it. I don't even know why they have school anymore. Kids could just Google everything.
That's true.
Because of Google, I'm my own doctor now.
Dr. Tenuta.
I'm my own doctor. I just Googled it, you know.
Well, what's great also, though, is it's that kind of movie where you watch it, the more you watch it, the more
it
you pick up, and you can just watch it again and again.
I watched it, I've seen it twice, and it's the kind of movie, you know how some movies you see at the theater and you like it?
Yeah.
But then you see it at home I don't think I'm allowed to mention different cable stations, but...
Yeah, you can.
On HBO, they showed it, and I love it. I love watching it. Like that. Yeah. You know, they rerun those. So
we're talking about the opening scene.
Yeah.
Where just that first 3 minutes
is
my favorite part of the movie.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Have you been to Paris? Have you all been to Paris?
Yes.
I was saying I haven't.
Oh, you have. Now you have to go.
I felt like I went there in that.
Go there, I think more near June and July.
And if you can go there in the 1920s, it's even nicer.
I know. If that's possible, I'll find a good travel agent.
It's beautiful, right? Yeah.
What did you think of all of the characters? Do you think they were all perfect for those roles? Or
like the guy who played, to me, Ernest Hemingway should win an award. I don't know. He wasn't nominated.
No, he was not.
And we were saying we're so surprised that the actor wasn't nominated in this.
Oh, he was so great.
And even Owen Wilson, just being like a natural.
Well, he was the guy going through it. He's the alter ego of Woody Allen, because Woody Allen didn't put himself in the movie. But he always gets a leading man to be him, kind of. So that's what he was doing.
Yeah. Oh. What did you think of Rachel McAdams?
Kind of like the not-so-likable, a very different role than normal.
I'm a fan of her. I love her. I just saw her in another film, her newest film, The Vow.
And that's her normal standard, is the romantic film where she's the heroine, but here...
Yeah, she was like...
You love to hate her.
I gotta go shopping. I can't be worried about...
Jim, I gotta go home.
I can't be worried about Ernest Hemingway. I gotta go shopping. Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
Although I don't mind going shopping with her.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course you've got to go shopping, but at night, you see how he... Oh, my God, the things he went to were so much better. Those parties with Zelda Fitzgerald and everybody, you know.
And so if you had to pick a moment in time that you would want to go back to, if you want to get in a car and go to a decade, would it be 1920s Paris?
I really like the time of all the Impressionist painters like Toulouse-Lautrec and Monet. I'd like to go back there. I think I'd like to go. But I love that, too. Can I do both?
So many options.
Fantasy, why not?
I want to do me both.
Well, at least this film gives everyone the chance to escape to 1920s Paris.
It is. Exactly. It's fantastic.
We were just talking about the look of it. This the way it looked. And
well, you know, he knows how to film. I mean, it's so beautiful the way he... You feel like you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
Which I think is... warm lighting being on camera. For people who go on camera, that's like your best...
Yeah, Dr. Tanuda, how do you feel about warm lighting?
Yes.
Oh, I bathe in warm lighting. I love warm lighting. Yes. Any warm lighting, of course.
Yes. Okay, good.
So Jessica, what was you say something? What was your favorite thing about the movie?
I've mentioned it 7 times, and if you can't figure out who that is, I've just...
Hemingway.
I'm in love with that Hemingway. I just thought he stole the picture. Right. He was like...
Because you
amazing.
Want a guy like that, right?
Because he embodied the character so well. And then he also... He was hot looking.
All right, see, that's what I'm talking about.
But Ernest Hemingway, when he was younger...
He was rakish.
Yeah.
So, when you went to see the film, what was your initial expectation? Were you just...
I'm a fan of the Woody Allen films, but I didn't expect to be so engaged in it. And I was just, oh my God, I was laughing so much. Because, see, I get all the references. You didn't get them right away. But, you know...
Well, let me ask you about that then, because there's been some talk about how... They wanted this to be a deeper film, and this was really light and kind of like set like this. So what were you thinking?
You know, here's what I think is great about it. A younger person can be educated about those great artists by having fun watching this, you know, and then you can go back and read about these people, you know.
Now, did you see it in, the first time, did you see it in theaters?
Oh, of course.
Okay,
you didn't see it from bed?
Theaters.
Like, these days, they all saw it from bed.
We got together, but we were in bed separately.
We all got together in bed.
Yeah, we all had a sleepover. But, okay, I didn't get this sense because I was in bed, but in theaters, I have to read this quote. Obviously, you got all the references, but Richard Rushfield of Daily Beast, I just love this quote summing up the movie. He said, "Viewings of Midnight in Paris on the big screen became events in the smug Olympics of the urban iPad class, with audiences risking physical injury as they competed to laugh the loudest to demonstrate that all around, yes,
that
they know who Gertrude Stein is." It was laughter directed at the audience itself, not at the screen, laughter to show that you got the joke. Did you feel that way? Was it
Here's what I felt like. I just felt like it was so well done that it drew me in, and I got all the references. But the casting was perfect. Yeah. Kathy Bates as Gertrude Stein impeccable.
Right.
And
here's what I thought.
Zelda Fitzgerald. She was so great.
Crazy.
Because she was a nut.
She's a nutbag. Exactly.
So great.
She was great.
In the theater, those who got it.
Right.
And those who didn't. You said, it didn't matter. So I didn't think it was a competition of who's going to get these references. I think that's a crock.
Okay.
I don't think that happened at all.
Rushfield.
It wasn't in the theater.
He's trying to make the movie into a contest.
Yeah. And
that's what everybody does now because of the social networking.
Yeah, no,
but the truth is, in and of, and that only helps promote the film.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. But I'm saying the film in and of itself is just so funny and great. And
you're saying it swept you in, even though you were in a movie theater, possibly among those types of people. It swept you in that way. It swept us in if we were home by ourselves doing, you know, whatever we were doing. And so we all agree, it sweeps you in and it takes you there.
Yeah.
And
I just wanted to be Owen Wilson and get and go back in time with all those guys.
I wanted to be Marianne Cotillard.
You want to be what?
Marianne Cotillard. Well, I want to be already living in 1920s Paris, and I want to be
so
gorgeous.
Wow. And a few others. I mean, she was obviously a muse's muse.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tanuda. We appreciate you coming by.
I have to go.
You better hop in the car.
Hi, Judy Tanuda. Where can everybody find you? Are you involved in a project you want to promote or anything?
Yes, I have a book coming all out
Thank you.
Called full frontal to nudity. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
That's great.
But it's not.
Tasteful.
Oh, it's so much fun.
And besides, even if you're naked, you are a doctor, so it's okay, right?
I'm a doctor. Yeah. It's a teaching experience. Yeah.
Full frontal to nudity.
Yeah.
Love
that's
it.
My book.
Thank you so
it's
much. Dr. Okay. Tenuta, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's take a quick picture standing up. Just
oh, we got to. Oh, wow. Okay. Really? You guys go.
Sorry, I get much higher when I stand up.
Oh, you're tall. That's good. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I have to say that my favorite part of the whole movie, not necessarily scene, because I loved every scene because it was so gorgeous, but my favorite part of the movie was when that smug Michael Sheen, when he's in the museum showing the painting of Picasso, and he's like, well, this is, he starts to explain it, and then Owen Wilson cracks and he's like, actually.
He finally jumps in.
And then he's like, because he was there the night before when they discussed how Marion Cotillard was the muse behind, he's like, actually, the inspiration was this, and I loved that. I love that he got back at him finally.
Right, because in real life, if that's really happening, you'd love to be able to get in there with that kind of jazz.
That was hilarious. And I don't know, maybe I was just way too into it, but I found myself at the end of the movie kind of wondering, what if? And I just kept thinking, what if Inez had gone with Gil? Or what if the car had come when he tried to drag her there? How would that have changed things? And I know it's totally stupid because...
It wouldn't work. She's not open to the magic.
Actually, I read in an interview that she said... Someone asked her that question. That is would be interesting, like, if she did go with him and she actually said, oh, she probably would have wanted to get right back anyway, even if she did go. She wouldn't want to be bothered with it. So, that's true.
One of my favorite, I like these little moments where Gil recommends to Buñuel, you know, you should make a movie about a dinner party where everything goes crazy. You know, referencing the movie he makes in 1962. Or when he turns to Gertrude Stein, she just bought him a tease and he goes, hey, can I get 6 or 7 of those?
Right.
You know, so he can make a killing when he goes back. Just little things like that, I love. Yeah. They were great.
And that's why if you watch it more and more, you pick up all those things.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, for me, I love movies that you could watch 20 times and still love. And that's like this kind of movie that is just in your DVD collection.
I wish you had more of those historical references, but I'm a history buff. I like that stuff. So.
And I love that you say that, Jackie, because I'm the kind of person, I rarely watch movies multiple times. It's like, once I've seen it, I don't buy the DVDs because I don't like knowing what's going to happen. It's just, there's no surprise element for me. But this is a movie, I've already seen it twice, and I probably...
You enjoy it?
I would buy the movie because it's a lot cheaper than a ticket to Paris, and I'm almost getting a vacation to Paris out of this.
Although it did make me want to buy a ticket.
Yeah.
So that may be an order,
you'll go.
Too.
You'll go.
Boosting tourism in one film. But I want to ask, at the end, when he ends up with the woman who sells the items to him, did you expect that? Because I kind of saw that coming, and I was so happy to see that at the end. I knew him and Marion Cotillard could never work.
Right.
Unfortunately.
I think it was the best case scenario, and... You know, that sort of sense of realism coming back, because obviously he's not going to run away with Marion Cotillard, but I feel like, you know, they call it a romance, like the whole thing of it. I think the romance that got me more than that real, you know, the relationships was the romance with the city. Like, I think that was the true romance. You know, they call it a romantic comedy. To me, that was the romance that took precedence.
Well, it's Woody's romance with the city.
Right, exactly. And, but
he left it a long time ago and he's finally coming back.
Right.
And I love that he did a romance to Paris. That's his thing. You know, romance with Manhattan, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, romance with Barcelona. He knows how to write a love story to a city like no one I've ever seen, except for maybe Sex and the City in New York.
So right. He's kind of like a polygamist with cities. Is that what you're saying?
He's
like
a character, too.
Yeah, the city, I think, is the main character. Paris is the main character in the film.
But I think this particular film, he's made, what, 40-plus films?
Yeah.
I think the reason this one is his most successful is because some of the other ones you may not relate to, but this is the kind of one where, like, pretty much everybody can fall in love with this story and fall in love with it. You know, like, it may not be for everybody, but it's so well done and so romantic and one of the two possibly best cities in the world, in my opinion, that even if you're not a huge Woody Allen fan of his style, just what this is, people who aren't Woody Allen fans will love it too. People who are Woody Allen fans will appreciate it. So I think that's what made this one so successful in comparison to some of those other ones, because I'm not the hugest Woody Allen buff. No. Like, I'm not gonna race to a theater because of Woody Allen. And this one pleased me, whereas, you know, some of his other ones, maybe not my style. But this pleased, I think, everybody, because it just touched upon something that everybody could love and appreciate. You know what I mean? Like, he had the best stuff to work with here. I mean, Paris, come on. The scenery, the imagery, everything about Paris is maybe equal to New York. I have to agree with him.
Jessica, were you a big Woody Allen fan coming into it?
You know, I loved Vicky Cristina Barcelona,
right.
And that was the only other Woody Allen fan that I had such a strong opinion about. So going into this, that's the last Woody Allen film I've seen. So going into this, I definitely had very high hopes, but before that, I wasn't.
And?
I don't know very much about Woody Allen. I hate that we're coming off as like, oh, the young people who don't get the references, who don't know Woody Allen, but I hate to say it. But that's why this film is great.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Everyone from the Woody Allen buff, from the history buff, right, to the people who don't know or don't care, and we all love the film.
And I've seen Woody Allen films since Bananas, so yeah. I've seen a ton of them.
And so then how does this compare to these classics?
It's hard to do that because it's a completely different genre than Sleeper or Bananas or anything like that. And I liken it more to Manhattan or Purple Rose of Cairo, with that mystical quality of this guy coming off the screen and reacting with people in the world.
Right.
So it has that magical thing going on it. I just accepted it for what it was. I don't really go into movies and, oh, well, it's a Woody Allen movie, I'm going to expect it. I just try to accept it for what it's presenting to me.
Right.
And I enjoyed it for that.
And I want to talk about the nominations, what they're nominated for.
What do we got, four?
They are nominated for, four nominations. So Best Picture, Best Original Screenplay, Best Art Direction.
And Best Director.
Best Director.
So, he's up for three.
So, unfortunately, I think they're only going to win one, but I think they have it on lockdown, and that's Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, he's already won a slew of awards for that.
Yeah, he already won the Golden Globe and the Writers Guild of America award against that, and he's up against March and Call, A Separation, The Artist, and Bridesmaids. Bridesmaids, and I love Bridesmaids, but yeah.
Like The Artist might be its biggest competition.
Yeah, I think it is.
Well, but Artist is going to win for Best Picture, and you got to be fair.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to win Best Picture here. I don't think Woody Allen is going to win Best Director, because I think The Artist is going to take that as well.
Do you think they'll give him a nod for the screenplay?
I think that
he's got the momentum going in for it.
Yeah. What about Art Direction? Because I think
they could possibly win that one. They're up against heavy hitters there too.
But
it's going to be a tough one.
I feel like I would have liked to have seen some of the cast get nominated as well.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, screenplay, I think at least if he comes away with that, it's, you know,
that's
recognizing the movie. But I do think that I would love to see an upset in one of the other categories.
Oh, sure.
And I want to see him win that, because he wasn't at the Golden Globes when he won.
Right.
So I'd like to see the speech.
I don't even know if he'll go.
Yeah, he's very limited about the press that he does.
The Academy Awards?
You know what's funny?
I have a great quote that he said, which was very interesting, because obviously everyone's asking him his opinion on all of this recognition right now and all of these nods for the different awards. And he says, "It's always nice. I make them for the fun of making them. I work at a comparatively low budget and make the films for my own enjoyment and hope that other people like them. And so it's always nice when they do. And in this case, people have embraced the movie. I must say, I'm now well beyond it. I've finished another movie already, and I'm preparing a movie for next summer. So for me, Midnight in Paris was something I did a few years ago. But nothing pleases me more than knowing people have gotten pleasure out of it. It's always a nice feeling."
All right.
He's not even caught up in all the
Isn't
that crazy?
It is crazy. But on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye.
So,
everybody, thank you very much for joining us for another AfterBuzz TV podcast. This is everybody. Please say hi or goodbye.
Jack Moran saying goodbye. Or au revoir.
Say bonjour.
Yeah, bonjour. Sir, Jessica King.
I'm Jessica King. It was great to hear you.
And saying goodbye from the Carrie Feinstein Oscar-style gifts lounge. Goodbye. We'll see you next time.
From Bing.com, executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.